Welcome back to the program. We've heard over and over again in the discussion about healthcare how one illness can literally change our lives. Imagine, though, if the illness can't be diagnosed and the symptoms lead to madness. We've all heard stories about medical mysteries, but when that mystery goes to the heart of the fine line between sanity and insanity, the results are something we all should take note of. We're going to talk about this today in the context of a bizarre and confounding illness that ravaged our guest in 2009 when she was 24 years old. She was a reporter for the New York Post, and in a matter of months, she would go from a successful New York young professional to one strapped to a hospital bed under 24-hour guard. She tells her story in her new memoir, Brain on Fire. It is my pleasure to welcome Susanna Cahalan here to talk about Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. Susanna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. You were leading, 24 years old, a pretty normal New York life, a young professional, a reporter for the New York Post, and you suddenly started feeling some strange medical symptoms.
Yes. Yeah.
You had bed bugs at first.
Yes. Yeah, of all things, really, it started with bed bugs. And, you know, and that was in 2009, and everyone thought they had bed bugs then. So, you know, they had been reportedly been in, you know, movie theaters and park benches. So, you know, when I thought that I had it, it didn't kind of raise a red flag for me just yet.
And what were some of the early symptoms that you started to notice?
Well, I had tingling in my left hand and numbness, which was disconcerting. But one of the doctors I went to actually thought I had mono. He thought it was just a kind of symptom of mono. And then I started acting kind of moody and unlike myself in many ways. I became really paranoid and jealous about my boyfriend, and I believed that he was cheating on me when he wasn't. I actually went through his things to kind of uncover evidence of his philandering, and they didn't exist. And these are things that are outside of my normal personality. But it wasn't at first big enough for me to say, oh, I need to check myself into a hospital. This is crazy.
What was your sense of the connection between the physical symptoms that you were starting to have and this odd behavior and this kind of out-of-character action that you started to take?
You know, I don't think I made the connection. I think when I was kind of told that these kind of the physical symptoms, as in the numbness in my hand, and then kind of I had migraine headaches as well, I kind of thought that was a whole separate issue. So I wasn't able to kind of see the bigger picture, and it's hard when you're talking about yourself to kind of see the bigger picture.
Right.
So I kind of disassociated the two. I said, okay, well, I have these migraines, and that's probably due to some kind of virus that I have. And then I have this erratic, you know, atypical behavior that I'm exhibiting. And that's a whole different thing. And I actually self-diagnosed myself with bipolar disorder. I believe that I have a bipolar disorder.
And in fact, because the symptoms were worsening, bipolar disorder was something that you and your family thought, well, that might be good because at least it could be diagnosed.
Exactly. I was thrilled, actually. I felt really that it explained everything. And I think the question of not being able to explain these kind of wide fluctuations in my behavior, I'd be laughing one minute and seriously the happiest I've ever felt in my life one minute and then sobbing the next. And to have a name for why that was happening was really important.
And it was beginning to impact your work as well.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, I couldn't do my work. I would come in, you know, completely unprepared, which is unlike me. I have a pitch meeting every Tuesday, and I just walked in with absolutely nothing to pitch, which had never happened before. And as the symptoms kind of worsened, I was crying and laughing at my desk. I was incapable of doing interviews, to the point that my coworkers looked at each other and said, "We need to call her mother because this is not okay. She's acting very, 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 you know, unhinged."
And you do this interview with John Walsh,
yes,
of America's Most Wanted fame, that goes incredibly badly.
Yes. That was, you know, it's kind of, looking back, I kind of find it funny in a way, because it's so bizarre. But at the time, it was horrible. So I went to interview him about drug smuggling submarines. And he had just done a interview at Fox News. We're in the same building as Fox News. And he had, you know, I recognized him immediately. And I remember kind of thinking about his son, Adam, who had been killed, and thinking all these inappropriate thoughts for an interview that was very straightforward. And I kind of just st- stared at him and laughed. And I think his publicist who was there actually thought that I was drunk or high or something because I was not acting normally. And I even walked them out after the interview and I was bumping against the walls because I just completely lost my equilibrium. So I didn't make a very positive impression on him, I don't think.
Talk about the medical part of this. You self-diagnosed as being bipolar. Mm-hmm. You had gone to doctors. What were they telling you?
So, you know, I had the whole mono thing, and then I actually had a doctor confirm that I had bipolar disorder, and I was put on medication. And then I was having seizures concurrently. So I actually kind of culminated with a seizure one night. And at that point, you know, you think, okay, the seizure is going to, you know, that's a very physical manifestation. You know, it's not a manifestation of a mental illness. You know, we'll find something, we'll figure it out. But the doctor, the neurologist that I went to actually said that I was going through alcohol withdrawal and that I was working too hard. And he actually stuck by that for a long period when I kept having seizures. My mom kept bringing me back in, and he just said, you know, you just have to give it some time. You know, she's been partying too much. And so my mom had to thrust a letter at him with all of my symptoms and just saying, this doesn't make any sense. She doesn't drink, you know, and she hadn't drank for 2 weeks and these seizures were still happening. Can you explain this? And eventually he agreed to have me placed at NYU Medical Center, and monitored there at the hospital.
And you had this one seizure that you talk about while watching a movie with your boyfriend one night, which was sort of this large grand mal kind of seizure.
Yes. Yes, that for me, that was that moment that it kind of breaks my sanity. And at that point, I don't remember much after that. Mm-hmm. So I had a grand mal seizure. You know, blood and foam came out of my mouth, and I was staring, you know, wide-eyed but unseeing. And my boyfriend had the sense, he knew that this was a seizure. I don't know how he knew that because he'd never seen one before, and he called 911. And after that moment, and after I woke up, that was the kind of mark. That was that line between insanity and sanity, and kind of after that, my ability to make long-term memories was completely shut off. So at that point, I don't really remember much.
That was what really brought you into contact with the doctors at NYU Hospital that would ultimately diagnose you.
Yes.
Talk about that.
So following the seizure, I was placed at NYU Medical Center after my mom battled for me to get in there. And I was placed on what is called the epilepsy floor. And there they do 24-hour monitoring with video cameras, and they have, you know, a tremendous staff of people because they're trying to monitor you for seizures. So I was placed there, and I actually stayed there for a month of my life at NYU Medical Center.
And when you see today those images, those pictures of what your seizures were like, talk about how you view that.
Well, you know, since they do have video footage of me, you know, on the floor, it's bizarre because I actually, at that point when I was in the hospital, I had become so unhinged and so psychotic, frankly, that I was actively hallucinating. I believed that news trucks were outside the hospital room, you know, waiting to interview me. You know, I had this kind of elaborate media, you know, hallucination that I was being persecuted by the media. And I also believed that I could age people with my mind. So I had all these kind of bizarre, you know, hallucinations, and some of them are actually captured on video. So there's video of me, you know, looking at the camera and shouting, "No, I'm on the news, I'm on the news," and staring at that person who is so scared and frightened and angry. You know, I've never seen myself be that way before, and it doesn't seem like me. It seems like someone else, but it is me. But I have no memory of experiencing. I mean, I have some of the memories of the hallucinations, but being in that body, I don't really remember what that's like. So it's just this kind of physical evidence that I was once, you know, so sick. It's very scary.
What kind of tests were being done?
So at that point, I mean, pretty much every test you can imagine. So, you know, blood tests, you know, MRIs, CAT scans, PET scans, I mean, everything you could think of, you know, lumbar punctures. Eventually, I had to have a brain biopsy. You know, the total cost of my care was over $1 million.
And all of that was covered by insurance?
Yes. I was very lucky. I was on insurance. I was full-time at the post, so I was on health insurance.
And yet, with all those tests, there was still no diagnosis.
Yes. So all those tests came back fairly positive. Negative. I mean, you know, I was a healthy individual, yet I was, you know, slipping further and further away. And at that point, about 2 weeks into the hospital stay, I was exhibiting signs of catatonia. So I had kind of progressed in a way, or regressed from psychosis, marked psychosis, you know, and hallucinations to catatonia, where I was not speaking, I couldn't write, I had no emotional register, I was drooling, I had abnormal arm movements to the point where I would leave my arms hanging out in the air almost like, you know, a mummy, and not even realize that they were there. So there are all these kind of, so the disease was progressing and I was getting worse and worse, and doctors were very worried that I was heading towards a comatose state.
And were there concerns that the causes were as much psychiatric as they were physical?
Yes. I mean, during that same time, I received a rule-out diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, which basically combines it's a thought disorder and mood disorder, so it combines symptoms of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So that's what I was diagnosed with in the hospital, and there was actually talk about moving me to a psychiatric ward. So that was definitely on the table until I met one doctor who kind of put it all together in one way.
And this was Dr. Najjar.
Yes. This is Dr. Najjar, who my mom nicknamed Dr. House. Though he has none of the same kind of personality traits as Dr. House. He's brilliant like Dr. House. But he came in and he saw things entirely in a different way. And it's not, I mean, he's brilliant, and don't get me wrong, but it's not even about the brilliance. It's about the way he handled me and the way he took care of me, and he cared, and he spent a long time with me. So he didn't just come in for 5 minutes on his rounds and leave. He spent a long time, and he sat there, and he took a full health history, which I think is key. I think that's a key thing. He asked me about the bed bugs were something that no one else had really focused on, and so all of a sudden, you know, he's kind of, what does this bed bugs mean in the larger scheme of things? And then, you know, the tingling, the numbness on the left-hand side, these things had been forgotten because my psychosis was so marked. So, you know, so at that point, he actually took in all of the big picture. And then he asked me to draw a clock, which became key to the whole diagnosis.
Describe the clock that you drew for him.
So he gave me a piece of paper and a pen, and he asked me to draw a clock. So I drew the circle. And I drew all the numbers 1 through 12, all on the right-hand side, nothing on the left. So the left was completely blank, which revealed to him, okay, this she likely has, her brain is inflamed, basically. He said after that
clock. He said your brain was on fire.
Yes, he said to my parents, her brain is on fire. Because basically what that clock revealed to him was that the right side of my brain, which is responsible for the left field of vision, was impaired in some way, and he believed that it was actually inflamed or on fire. So this goaded him into, you know, being very, very adamant that this was a neurological cause. You know, this was a neurological disease. And he didn't know what the disease was yet, but he was able to say with certainty that this was not a mental illness.
And what additional test was he able to do to verify that hadn't already been done?
Well, ultimately, I was diagnosed via a lumbar puncture, or spinal tap, and it was sent at the time to the one place in the world that tested for the disease I was ultimately diagnosed with. One little place at University of Pennsylvania, one lab, test for it, and I was the 217th person to be diagnosed with what is called anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis.
And this was something that was only first discovered in 2007.
Yes, yes. I was treated in 2009. It was discovered in 2007, you know, which it begs many questions, but, you know, one of the questions is how many people had gone throughout history undiagnosed.
Were you told, did you have a sense of what would happen even after you were diagnosed, if it had not been treated?
Yes. I mean, you know, of course, there are no kind of long-term studies because of how recently it was diagnosed. But people die without treatment. People maintain severe cognitive disabilities. So those were kind of the outcomes that could have happened. You know, and a lot of people end up in psychiatric wards or nursing homes, you know, in a way, if they're lucky, because people do die from this. Eventually, as the disease progresses, as I was saying, you know, you go from psychosis to catatonia, and then you go to coma, and then death, as the brain becomes more and more impaired.
And it's an autoimmune disease.
Yes. It's basically when your body's immune system, the antibodies in your immune system attacks these certain NMDA receptors in the brain.
Why didn't this show up in any other tests?
That's a really good question. I think at this point, I mean, MRIs don't show any. In about 50% of cases, sometimes they'll show some signs of there's something going on in the brain. It won't be conclusive. You won't be able to diagnose it through an MRI. But in all of my MRIs and CAT scans, everything, it was completely normal. My brain looked healthy. So I think because it's on such a, micro level, you have to use the spinal serum to actually show that there are these issues, because it is such, it's on the receptor level, which is such a micro level, so you can't see it almost in the other tests.
And in fact, once you were diagnosed, they still couldn't tell you what triggered it, what caused it.
No, and in fact, that remains a large mystery. So, you know, they know that you need to have some kind of genetic inclination to make these kind of rogue antibodies. So these antibodies that attack your brain, you have to make them yourself. But there also has to be some kind of other trigger, an environmental trigger, and that environmental trigger can be anything. You know, I kind of thought that maybe it was this businessman who sneezed on me in the subway. I thought, okay, maybe that triggered it all. You know, it could be anything, which is frankly terrifying. But
when you look back at this and look at your behavior and what went on while you were suffering from this disease, what, if anything, does that tell you about what we're all capable of and how what we all have in us and how we're all capable of the strangest behavior and things in our personality that may only come out under those kind of situations?
You know, I believe that this disease kind of robs you of your personality. I don't think that it uncovers kind of deep parts of yourself that you've hidden away. I think it kind of brings you to a very base part of yourself,
mm-hmm.
the kind of animalistic primal part. I think that's where it kind of taps into, that we all have. You know, we all have the ability to be violent and psychotic if our NMDA receptors are affected. What it kind of showed me was how I'm at the whim. We are all at the whim of our bodies, and I was at the whim of a receptor in my brain I never even knew existed before. You know, and you tamper with those, and you change everything about yourself. All the virtues that you think that you know who you are, all your personality, every single part of yourself that you take for granted. This is who I am, right? I would never kick and punch nurses. You know, that's not something I would do. All of a sudden, that it robs you of that, and you realize that we are just kind of all at the whim of our bodies, and you know. It's very scary, actually.
At the whim of our bodies, and also that very fine line that we can cross over to become more primal.
Oh, yes. And it's a fine line. I mean, and what's so scary about this disease is how subtle it started, because it was so, there were kind of these, like I said, these kind of small, subtle signs that I was off. But everyone experiences off days. Everyone has days when they don't feel like themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's almost, this disease is kind of sinister in that way. You know, before it kind of takes hold of you, it kind of takes you down piece by piece, you know?
How were you treated once they knew what it was?
The treatment was fairly simple. I had a treatment of steroids and immune therapies. So basically, what these immune therapies and steroids do is they suppress the immune system, and then the immune therapies flush out bad antibodies and replace them with new antibodies. It's very simple. Some people, especially some children who have relapses, have to go through chemotherapy, but I didn't have to do that.
And how long before you felt that you had fully recovered?
It's a hard question to answer. But I would say about a year and a half after my diagnosis, I felt comfortable in my body again. I mean, you know, I had gone back to work about 6 months after my diagnosis, but you know, and then I would have said, I'm 100%, I'm fine, but I recorded my interviews because I couldn't keep up typing, because I wasn't back. And I can hear my voice, I'm slurring, I'm slow, you know, I'm not as kind of quick as I would later be, and so I'm really a bad judge of myself, mm-hmm. I've proven to be, but I would say about a year and a half.
Much of this that you write about, you don't really remember. You really pieced it together as if you were a reporter doing a story,
yes.
And your dad also kept a journal.
Yes, that was a big part of this, because I don't remember what happened in the hospital, because the NMDA receptors are in high quantities in the hippocampus, which is a kind of a waylay station to make long-term memories. So it's a really pivotal part in the conversation of in the brain of making memories, right? So that was really impaired. So I didn't have the ability to make memories. So that whole time, pretty much the whole hospital stay is one blank spot in my life. So I had to actually recreate it for the book and recreate it really for myself. I had to, you know, use my dad's journals, which he kept during the time, which were immensely valuable to me and very very hard to read. And then, I had thousands of pages of medical records. I had those videos. I had interviewed doctors and nurses and my family and my friends to kind of piece together that month, because I don't remember it.
Is there any lasting long-term impact, according to the doctors?
You know, that is a question they haven't been able to answer me. You know, I think my brain was so devastated during the height of this disease that I think it's probably impossible that it didn't leave some kind of biochemical marker on my brain. Now, is it significant? I don't think so. You know, I'm here right now talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that if you go through something that profound, you know, it has to leave some kind of trace there.
Of course, not unlike other kinds of trauma to the brain has a way of working around and rewiring
exactly.
And changing itself.
It's resilient. I mean, it's the brain is incredibly resilient. You know, neurogenesis, I mean, that's kind of, you know, part of the reason why I'm back is just being able to sprout these new receptors. So, I mean, it just shows you that is, you know, on the flip side of what we talked about before in terms of how we are kind of victim to our bodies, it's kind of incredible to show how resilient our bodies can be as well. So there's kind of a flip side to that whole argument.
What are the dangers of relapse from this?
Unfortunately, there is a relapse rate. So that's about 19% relapse. When I wrote the book, it was 25%. Now it's 19% as more research has become available. So that is, you know, that's a scary number. But it's, what is good about it is that you have the same percentage chance of recovery if you do get it again. And this disease is all about swift intervention. So, of course, if I start exhibiting any of these signs, I have a very good rock-solid support system around me that will kind of, you know, jump into gear if they see me acting erratically.
Have you had the opportunity in your research to talk to others that have been through this disease and recovery?
Yes, and that's kind of been an amazing gift of this whole thing. You know, I was recently in Miami, and I met a woman there whose son had what I had, and we had a whole lunch, and we talked. And I know that a lot of parents, because a lot of children have this disease, like to talk to me because their children, it's as young as 2 years old. You know, I've heard about even 6 month-year old, 6 months old, having this disease. So you can't really, the child can't verbalize it. So a lot of parents have been reaching out to me, and they've wanted to talk to me about their own experiences, and that's been a tremendous gift. And I've helped through sharing my own story. You know, help people find a diagnosis or help people find the right doctors. I mean, that's what you hope to do as a journalist, is to help people.
It's also a disease that certainly might have been looked at in various times gone by as things that put out all the signs of some kind of possession.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you take a look at the disease, you know, in a different context and a different time,
mm-hmm.
you know, I say, take me, for example, my unnatural movements, my grunting, you know, this kind of blood and foam coming out of my mouth, this violence, you know, that, you know, very much, a different time and place, could look supernatural. And I've talked to other people who are, I'm not a very religious person, but I've talked to other people who are from religious families, and that's part of their kind of identity. And my hallucinations happened to be about the media. Their hallucinations were that the devil was inside them, or that they were channeling Jesus Christ. I mean, these are people I've talked to who have had these hallucinations. So, and the hallucinations can be of a kind of religious nature as well. So if you kind of take that all in, you could be looking at something that it was like the demonic possession, definitely.
And this then becomes something that you have to monitor, as you mentioned before, for the rest of your life, and is kind of a pre-existing condition, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it is. And with the relapse rate, it is, definitely.
And which means that you have to deal with the insurance realities going forward as well.
Yeah, that's scary. I hope that we will not be able to discriminate based on that. I think that's absurd. But yeah, I mean, it's a reality that I have to face, definitely.
How do your friends deal with this when they talk to you now and those that saw you during this period?
You know, I've had so many wonderful people kind of come out of the woodwork with this and be so supportive. And I think a lot of people, to move forward and to treat me like, you know, a friend, had to kind of put that out of their mind. So now that the book is out, they're kind of reliving that time in a way, and in a different way than they did then. So they're kind of seeing a more complete story. And so many people and friends have come up to me and said, I had no idea it was this bad, or I had no idea this story, you know. So I think in a lot of ways I'm reliving it with them now, and they're kind of able to ask me the questions that they were uncomfortable asking me then, because it was uncomfortable. People didn't really understand about this autoimmune disease. They thought maybe I was going crazy. I mean, you know, people, it wasn't out there then the way it is now. So I think they're now kind of able to ask those questions they've been kind of, you know, brushing aside for a couple of years now.
Susanna Cahalan, the book is Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. Susanna, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Appreciate it.